On this week's 51%, we meet two women who are speakers at an annual Women in Power conference. One woman looks at the power in restoring civil discourse, while the other transforms pain into power.
You move pain into power by doing service work and working in the community and, you know, reaching out to people.
I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Women of the world, take over. Because if you don't, the world will come to an end. And we haven't got long.
Each year, the Omega Women's Leadership Center at the Omega Institute in Rhinebeck, New York, holds its Women in Power retreat. This year, October 6th through 8th, the theme is Do Power Differently. One of the keynote speakers is Joan Blades, a founding partner of Living Room Conversations. Blades had co-founded MomsRising.org and MoveOn.org. She's also an artist, mother, and believer in the power of citizens and the need to rebuild respectful civil discourse and embrace our core shared values. For the Omega Conference, Blades will lead a Living Room Conversations project and talk about the need to foster good relationships with people who have different viewpoints.
We have a practice that's just a very simple tool that allows us, two friends with different viewpoints, to each invite two friends to have a structured conversation where everyone's agreed to ground rules that are, you know, basically what you learned in kindergarten: take turns, be respectful, be curious, own your part of the conversation. And then they've chosen a topic where they start by talking a little bit about their deeper values, so that by the time they're talking about the topic, they have a sense of who they're with and like each other. And we know that once people really like each other, they hear each other in a very different way. Then there are some open questions about the topic selected. And the Living Room Conversation closes with reflection on, you know, what people have heard and if there's anything they want to do based on what they heard. And this is something that doesn't require a facilitator. So I'm a founder of Move On and Moms Rising as well. So I've seen movements really grow and be big. And this is something where people all around the country can do this, because more and more we live in self-selected bubbles. And I was born in Berkeley, California. And as a founder of Move On, it just became clear to me at a certain point that there are other viewpoints out there that I wasn't hearing. And when I had the opportunity to make friends with people with very different viewpoints, I understood better what the obstacles were. You know, I wanted to know, why aren't conservatives concerned about climate change? And I was able to ask those questions and have some really good conversations back in 2005, 2006, and, you know, make some friends. And by 2009, I saw that the capacity for people to have those conversations was diminishing, that the boundary between left and right was getting harder to go across. And that we had more and more different facts, and we can't have a healthy democracy with different facts. So this is an opportunity for us as citizens to really start to heal the rifts that have grown between us. And we can choose whatever we want to talk about. We have over 60 conversation guides up right now, but it's an open source project where we've invited people to take it and run with it and get back to us. And so if there's another topic that people want to get into, there's everything you need to be able to write those conversation rounds. And we're also available to help, because the Living Room Conversations team is very diverse.
You know, you mentioned obstacles to civil discourse, and then you gave the example of speaking with conservatives about climate change. I'm wondering if you could expand upon what obstacles you found en route to civil discourse.
Well, we have been seeing a very combative way of relating to each other in the media, in politics. I keep on seeing these talking points, and people don't actually talk to each other. They're just having this ongoing sharing of talking points where nobody changes anybody's mind. And what we really need is everyone's best ideas in the room and to figure out solutions to the significant challenges we face together. We all want to have a robust infrastructure, yet we seem to be stuck and unable to make progress because everyone's so committed to a certain way of looking at each other that makes the other guy, the other person, them, as opposed to a good person that sees another way of doing things, perhaps. You know, we're in a paralyzed position until we start to relate to each other. This is one tool for beginning that process, and it's certainly not the whole story, but it's a really great way to start.
Have you introduced it to Congress, Living Room Conversation?
Yes, well, I would gladly do that, but they haven't yet invited me. I don't know why. The reality is, though, that as I look at politics, leaders are actually being punished when they work well together or when they try to work together, because we've become so polarized throughout the system. The rigidity has been reinforced. And so we need to create a safe place for people to begin to talk to each other and see each other as caring human beings, because most people are. You know, having a relationship with each other is the starting point to being able to hear each other. And if we are going to succeed as a democracy, we need to do it together.
I wanted to talk with you about the why and the when of the founding of Living Room Conversations. Certainly it wasn't January 1st, 2017, and yet there is a greater need for civil discourse than ever, it seems. And I'm not attributing that to one side or the other. It's both.
I co-founded it. I was really careful about co-founding Living Room Conversations because you can't do this without many voices in the room. And so I did it with conservative and independent partners, right? We did the pilot project in 2010, 2011, 2013. I co-hosted a Living Room Conversation with Mark Meckler, the co-founder of Tea Party Patriots. And we had this wonderful conversation about crony capitalism with his friends and my friends, and came to some a remarkable number of realizations that we were in agreement about issues about banks not being able to gamble with our money and get to keep the proceeds when they win and get insured when they lose, about criminal justice issues like too many people in prison, the war on drugs is not a success, and we have to use evidence-based practices when dealing with the criminal justice system. That started me doing work with Mark on stage and elsewhere that has ended up in some really very significant left-right partnerships to try and improve the system, which unfortunately takes a lot more work than it should, because it's still we are still just beginning to reform. And I am sorry to say that right now Jeff Sessions is sounding like last century when it comes to criminal justice issues. And I think we very badly need people on the right and left to step up and start to help us reform the system so it's actually working to create more safety and healthy communities for all of us.
Is there a difference in the Living Room Conversations when it comes to gender? Have you found anything along gender lines?
That's really interesting. We do have a Women in Power conversation. You know, when we put together a conversation, or when I do, I should say, anyone can do it however they choose to, I often think about gender balance, among other things. And women are very attracted to this practice, maybe even some more than men. And I think more and more men are showing up because it's highly effective. And this may just be my own bias, but I think there is an element of women being peacemakers. And I love that about women. I want to see more and more men here with us, and I think we will see more and more men. But we have a lot of women in leadership, which is awesome. And maybe part of it's because I go to something like the Omega Institute Women in Power Weekend and speak there and recruit more women. So there is that element too.
What is the conversation we need to have that we're not having?
Oh, you know, there's so many. We are currently working on making a version of the relationships first conversation that helps people feel more ready for the holidays. I've always noted that family is the one group I don't guarantee the living room conversation with, because family, they're the people who break the rules of host and guest. The traditions of host and guest are very powerful containers, honestly. But family is the one group that breaks that. Well, it turns out people have such pain right now because they have lost or diminished relationship with people they care about deeply due to politics. And we are now looking at that because we have our people using these conversations saying, you know, this really helped when I went back and talked to my dad, or I invited some of my, you know, nephews to join a conversation. And we've realized that, okay, well, people know this is what they want, and they're gaining, you know, the understanding of just how powerful it is to listen, that maybe they can't do a living room conversation during the holidays with family, but the skills that they're developing improve their capacity to appreciate the people that they care about but don't always agree with.
How has a living room conversation enabled you to see another side? How have you had a breakthrough via one of these conversations?
Well, you know, climate is a huge issue for me because the world as we know it can't support future generations. Everything else becomes secondary. And I have seen from my conservative friends, some of them have such optimism about technology and what we can do and how the free market can really change everything and make it right. So I am seeing the power of having the free market be a huge part and investment of solving the climate problem. And, you know, that there are more win-wins in this than I had conceived of to start with. Yeah, I love being around the optimism, honestly. It's really helpful for me.
That was Joan Blades, a founding partner of Living Room Conversations. Dr. Norma Bowe also is on the speaker agenda at Omega's Women in Power Conference. She has transformed pain into power in her own life and helps others achieve the same. Bowe has activated generations of homeless women and girls to empower themselves. She's a professor at Kane University in New Jersey and is widely known around campus as the professor with the most popular class there. Death in Perspective has a 3-year waiting list.
I'm sort of the grief expert for the panel that will have mothers that are turning pain into power. One of the mothers that I've been very closely connected to since the death of her son is Gwen Carr, Eric Gardner's mom. I have a medical background, so when I watched the video of Eric literally dying on the street in Staten Island, I reached out to her because as a mother and as a woman, I could only imagine the pain of watching something like that on a video. And then, of course, got very involved in the march, the marches, and some of the other, you know, very active movement going on around all of the folks that were being, you know, shot and killed at the same time, it seemed, right around the country. And I love this Omega Women in Power retreat because it really helps to bring women together and share stories and share experiences and network to, you know, be able to move issues forward. I run a small organization called Be the Change, and we've been so lucky and really grateful for the support that we've gotten from Omega. I've been able to bring young women from a teen homeless shelter, for instance, 1 year, to the Women in Power retreat. And they were able to meet so many influential women, women that told them, never stop giving up, you know, don't give up hope. Don't give up before the miracle happens. And literally, I think I had 10 girls that summer that we went for the retreat, and 7 of them signed up for college right after the retreat was over. It was a summer retreat. And by September, we had 7 of those young women at my university as students. So they're no longer homeless living in a teen shelter when they can be college students living in the dorm. And we've also taken some of what Omega has taught us you know, out into the streets, we're running a young women's leadership initiative at Elizabeth Coalition to House the Homeless. Now, I'm the grief specialist on the panel that's happening. And, you know, there is a way to weave pain into power, and that is to become active, you know, around that pain and to tell your story and, you know, to be willing really to share with others.
Let's just talk about this pain into power, right? You generally talk about what you know. So maybe you could go back to the beginning, in a sense, and talk about your pain and how you transformed it into power.
Yes. You can only really be an expert in what you know best, I suppose. I grew up in a very chaotic family. There was a lot of violence in my household. I didn't know if I would be alive from one day to the next. My father had guns and knives, and my parents fought my cats and dogs that often would be in the hospital. A lot of physical abuse came my and emotional abuse came my way as well. And then I became a nurse, you know, and I was on the other end, working in the ICU and the ER, and then eventually in psychiatry. And then I got my PhD in community health policy, and now I teach. I'm a full-time professor at King University in New Jersey, and I took over this death class. It's called Death in Perspective, and I rewrote the whole course once they gave it to me to teach, because it was very much sort of an abstract idea about death, and I made it very concrete by bringing students to field trips and, you know, really exploring their own grief. In my college classes, for instance, when I ask the question, how many of you know someone who's been murdered, 3/4 of the class raised their hand. 100% of my students know someone who's died. You know, so pain into power, it's sort of tapping into this resiliency, coming up with coping strategies, developing this inner core of strength to know that you have worth and to know that you have power really to shepherd your own ship. Like, we are the sole creators of our one wild and precious life, as Mary Oliver, you know, in her poem Summer Day says, what doesn't everything die at last and too soon? What will you do with this one wild and precious life? So we can't wallow in pain. I mean, we can certainly feel the pain. We can honor that pain, but we can't wallow in it, because there's just too much important work to be done. And, you know, we have to be able to find the support systems and find people who have struggled and gone through similar things that we've gone through in order to forge forward.
You know, we all experience pain. I'd be surprised if someone said he or she did not. But it's one thing not to wallow and get on with it, as it were. And it's another to get on with it and empower people around you and effect change and all sorts of things. I mean, what is the difference? What makes one person just, as I said, get on with it, and the other get on with it and a whole bunch of other things?
Well, you know, I've really learned through teaching my class. I had an LA Times journalist follow me around for a year, and then 4 years after that, sporadically, and wrote the book, The Death Class, A True Story About Life, that came out a few years ago and has really blown up. But I am convinced, I am absolutely convinced that you move pain into power by doing service work and working in the community and, you know, reaching out to people and coming up with, you know, creative ideas about how to get justice, for instance. You know, when it comes to Gwen Carr, who's really become a very close personal friend of mine now, and some of the other mothers that will be at the retreat, you know, mothers who have lost their children to the streets. And I think getting out into the community, giving back, doing things in honor of your pain, kind of changing the paradigm, switching the pain into something that's creative and good rather than have it continually be something negative and sad. And I've seen this over and over again with my Be the Change group. We do community service projects all over the country now. I just got back from Houston last night, where we were doing hurricane relief work. And the more you can put your energy into something like that, into something good for the community, I think the more healing takes place. For instance, we have a project where we're homicide mapping all of Newark, New Jersey, which has crime rates 10 times greater than the rest of the country. And once we figure out where all the homicides are, we take an abandoned lot and we flip it into a pocket park or a garden for the community. We ask them, what would you like to see in place of this abandoned lot? And they tell us. And then along with the community, we turn it into a beautiful garden. And now we're doing research watching the crime rates drop around these little green spaces that we've created. We feed the homeless every week. We have this Young Women's Leadership Initiative that we've been doing now for a year.
I wanted to go back to a statistic you mentioned earlier that's been circling in my mind, and that is you said 75% of your students in your death class say that they know someone who's been murdered. That seems like an awfully high percentage.
Listen, this is really, this is another whole untapped bunch of information. Our young people in this country are carrying a lot of grief. They have a lot of grief. My students have a lot of grief. They are losing their friends to the drug epidemic, which here in New Jersey is just horrific. I don't know what the current statistics are of how many people are dying a day, but I do take my students to autopsy trips. And last semester in the spring, we saw 19 folks dead in the autopsy room. 13 of them are drug overdoses. You know, so this is a real huge problem. So they're losing their friends to the drug epidemic. They're losing their friends to the streets. Every semester, it's 75% of my students. I have lost someone to murder. All of them know someone who's died. 50% of them know someone who's committed suicide. It is affecting, it's sort of a collective grief for the entire community, you know, and when you're only 25 or 22 or 20, and you can rattle off five people that you've known that have died, you know, friends of yours, it's really a lot of grief. So this class is just a very uniquely positioned to deal with grief and then what to do with all of that pain and sorrow and anger a lot of times, you know. And then really the class is about how to live your best life. What is your purpose? You know, what can we do in honor of people that are no longer here? How can we live our life the best way? And most of the folks that I have are seniors because it takes 3 years to get into the class. And so it's a really wonderful sort of send-off gift for people who are graduating to kind of develop a life map in this course. And I love it. I mean, you can tell I'm very passionate about it.
Are there more women than men in your class, or is it 50-50? And are the reactions different based on gender?
Yes, absolutely. That was such a good pickup. It is split half and half, for sure. And men, you know, they keep all this grief in. They feel like they have to be strong. We talk about it. There's actually an enzyme in tears that boosts your immune system. So when you cry, it's actually your body's way of making sure you're not going to get sick. But the men are very reticent to really share their emotions. They'll share their story. And the stories of these students are just incredible, really incredible. We do homework assignments like write a goodbye letter to someone or something that you've lost. We tell our fire story. We write our fire story down, the most difficult experience we've ever had. And then who was there for you? How did you get through it? Sort of trying to pour a little miracle grow on those little roots of resiliency, you know? And then when we share those stories in class, there are all these connections. Well, your story's connected to mine, and mine sounds a lot like yours. And then all of a sudden, everybody in this course becomes friends, and they keep in touch for years. I've got, I don't even know how many Facebook pages from Death and Perspective, you know, 2012, 2015, and they just stay connected to each other. Women are much, much better at sharing the emotional impact that grief has had on their life.
That was Dr. Norma Bowe, professor at Kane University in New Jersey. The Women in Power Retreat at the Omega Women's Leadership Center at the Omega Institute in Rhinebeck, New York, takes place October 6th through 8th. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1471.